Everyone, how's the beer? How's the beer? You're okay? How's the Mexican food? We've got it all. We got Mexican food, we got beer, we got great companionship, we got a great philosopher tonight. We're really glad that you guys are here. We got almost a full house, don't we, Dr. Elkick? Really, really awesome. Dallas Philosophers Forum is dedicated to bringing philosophy and ideas to an interested Dallas Metroplex. And I'm Rob Olson. I want to thank everyone again for coming out. We meet on the second and the fourth Tuesday of every month. That's from September through May. And the cost is $5, the best bargain in town. And so if you haven't paid, you can pay Dr. Elkick, our esteemed treasurer, after the meeting is over. And if you're a student with an ID, or even if you're a student without an ID, we trust you. We're an ethical organization. We trust you, and you can just pay $2. So anyway, students are welcome. And we've got some Midwestern State University folks. Let's give them a round of applause. They drive in from Wichita Falls. How long the drive is that, like 2 hours?
2.5 hours.
They drive in. These are dedicated philosophy students, let me tell you. 2.5 hours they drive in, and we're really, really glad that they're here. And that's a great program up there. I've had a couple of their professors that have spoken into our group before. I also want to remind you that if you want to become a subscriber, it's $35 for 6 months. You can pay David Elkick there. And I remind you to pay for your meals and your drink and all after the session, after the meeting. Every once in a while someone will inadvertently forget to pay, and then we have to pick that up. So we are a not-for-profit organization, so just a reminder there. Also, does everyone have our fall schedule? If you don't have your fall schedule, I've got copies. It's also on our Philosopher's Forum website, www.philosophersforum.org. And also you can sign up with the meetup group. That's www.meetup.com, Dallas Philosophers Forum, and you can sign up. How many of you have come and learned about us through Meetup? Okay, so several of you all have come through Meetup. So, and we thank our board member, Carl, for getting that all set up. So tonight, we are very privileged to have our speaker. He'll be speaking for 45 minutes, and we'll open it up for questions. And then one last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them on pleasure or vibrate mode at this time. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. We're very privileged to have Dr. Robert Wood here tonight. Dr. Wood is professor of philosophy in the Institute of Philosophic Studies at the University of Dallas. He earned his PhD at Marquette University and his bachelor's and his master's at Marquette University. What city is that? That's in Illinois?
Wisconsin.
I'm off one state. Sorry about that. From 1989 to 2009, he was the editor of the American Catholic Philosophical Quarterly, and in 1994, the president of the American Catholic Philosophical Association. He has published over 80 articles on aesthetics, metaphysics, and anthropology during the course of his career. And I went on and read his bio, and some of the fascinating, most fascinating articles. There's an article on music and philosophy, an article on poetry, Martin Buber, which he wrote, Dr. Wood wrote his dissertation on. There is articles on Dostoevsky, Hegel, Nietzsche, Phenomenology of the Mailbox. Phenomenology of the Mailbox. Heraclitus, the Weeping Philosopher, he's written about Heraclitus. So any questions you have afterwards, whether it's about the U.S. Postal Service, about Heraclitus, if it's about who's better, Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, of course, then you can ask any of these questions that you want, because this is a truly a man who has written about a wide variety of areas, a Renaissance man. So anyway, tonight he will be speaking on Plato's treatment of justice in a Christian worldview. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Wood.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here. Hope my voice will hold up. I've got a cold, but I'll go on anyhow. Can you hear me all right back there? Okay, good. Throughout its history, Christianity has drawn upon Plato and Neoplatonism to interpret and mediate its message. Especially since Bultmann, there has been talk of the need for de-Hellenization. Yet Martin Heidegger, who drew from and influenced Bultmann, also claimed that the phenomenology he practiced was a return to Plato and Aristotle. That may seem somewhat startling. It did startle me when I first read it. But when one examines the practice of these two giants, one realizes that much of what they were doing, as Plato put it in his Phaedrus, was carving along the joints. That is, the distinctions and relations in experience and the objects of experience, and not hacking through like a clumsy butcher, is how he put it. Describing the field of experience and the different acts and objects that comprise it. Insofar as that is the case, Plato and Aristotle remain perennially irrelevant, since experience has an invariant structure through all the differences that different cultures and epochs exhibit. So today I want to practice a retrieval of Plato's thought on the question of justice in order to interpret the Christian message today. I want to do so by a presentation of the treatment of justice in the Republic. Plato's thought in general is a fabric woven out of hard-twisted vertical and soft-twisted horizontal strands as modes of intellectual display. The former, the hard-twisted vertical strand and weaving, is apodeixis, or showing from the top down. It's realized paradigmatically in geometrical demonstration, where you move from axioms and postulates to theorems. It's also realized in definitional systems, hierarchies of genera and species proceeding from the highest genus. The other strand consists in paradigmata, apodeixis, showing from the top down, paradigmata, or showing alongside, and is related, it is realized in metaphors, diagrams, allegories, and myths. The latter incarnate human thought in imagery, and for all the dualistic language that Plato employs with regard to the human soul, his thought is essentially incarnate in images. As part of the soft-twisted strands, metaphors, or rather metaphoric pairs, structure the Republic. The opening words are carefully chosen. I went down to the Piraeus yesterday and was about to return up to the city. The physical going down and going up is a metaphoric pair for injustice and justice, going down and going up in human life. When are we as humans going up and going down? Is there a measure? Is it the stock market? Socrates and Glaucon and his companion decided to stay into the night to watch a torch-like procession on horseback. We are presented here with another closely related metaphoric pair, namely light and darkness. Going up is going into the light, going down is descending into the darkness. These pairs furnish a basic structure to the work. They're not arbitrarily chosen, they're built into the fabric of human life. Before the invention of electrical lighting, when the sun went down, people lay down to sleep. When the sun rose, they rose up to the light of day. We spontaneously use these metaphoric pairs to speak of human values. The central question of the dialogue, the nature of justice, is introduced through Socrates' meeting with old Cephalus, a rich man offering sacrifices to the gods. He remarked that when he was young, he thought the good was pleasure. When he got older, he thought it was riches. He made a fortune as a shield maker. Now that death is approaching, he thought it just might be justice. This is where Socrates raises the central question as to the nature of justice. It is a thought of death that leads Cephalus to question his own life as a whole. At the end of the dialogue, Plato concocts the myth of Er, who was supposed to have gone into the afterlife and seen the rewards and punishments meted out according to justice or injustice in their lives. He was allowed to come back to talk about them. Death and the possibility of an afterlife furnished the utterly sober context of raising the question of the nature of justice. In the beginning, Socrates teases a kind of definition out of Cephalus. Justice is telling the truth and paying back what you owe. You might call this commercial justice. His son Polemarchus picks up the argument and claims that what are owed are benefits to friends and harm to enemies. You might call this interstate justice. Benefiting allies and harming enemies, that's still practiced throughout history. Thrasymachus places everything in a new light, claiming that justice is the self-interest of the stronger, and that laws are made by the stronger in their own self-interest. For their subjects, justice consists in obeying the law. We might call this realistic justice, the justice typically practiced in states. Socrates shows himself the strongest in argument and explains what true human self-interest entails as he rules the assembled interlocutors. What I find one of the most significant aspects of the subsequent extended argument is the way he frames the question of the just and unjust man. He does so in relation to a central aspect of interpersonal relations, the distinction between appearance and reality. Martin Buber called attention to 8 views involved in any dyadic relationship between people. I as I appear to you, you as you appear to me. I as I want to appear to you, and you as you want to appear to me. I as I appear to myself, and you as you appear to yourself. And finally, I as I really am, and you as you really are. Socrates picks up on these complications by invoking the myth of the ring of Gyges. A shepherd found the ring on a corpse in a cave, put it on, and found that when he turned the signet around, he disappeared. He then used his invisibility to seduce the queen and kill the king. Here Socrates asks us to perform a thought experiment. What if you had the ring of Gyges? What would you do and not do? Most good people would say they would do just what they regularly do. But the experiment has a deeper dimension. What if you disappeared not only from the eyes of men, but also from the eyes of God? A recent survey indicated that 85% of those surveyed said they would do what they felt like doing. So how does the idea of God function? As a stick and a carrot, threatening hellfire to those who break his commandments and promising heavenly bliss to those who follow him. Socrates' point is to see what justice and injustice do to the soul, or the inner life of those who practice them, whether man and God see it or not, and consequently without consideration of what external benefits and harms might accrue from practice. With that as a challenge, Socrates asks us to reverse the relation between appearance and reality, making the truly just man appear unjust, and the truly unjust man appear just. The latter would reap all the rewards given by others for his appearance, the former would reap the disadvantages meted out by the public. In this context, Plato has to have Socrates himself in mind, was executed by the Athenians for questioning the values and practices of the city-state. With that as a challenge, Socrates asks us to reverse the device he uses to display the inner character of the order or disorder of the soul is the construction of a city. His reason seems a bit odd. Since we can't see the relatively small character of the soul, we can see that character writ large in the city. But the move does not appear to be so odd when we reflect on the mirror relation between city and soul. People tend to reflect the values functioning in the people around them and in the culture as a whole. He presents the city in 3 stages. The first is based upon fundamental need. Socrates calls it the true and healthy city. Most insistent is the need for food, clothing, and shelter that are provided by a relatively simple division of labor. Glaucon focuses upon that and disregards what the people do on holidays, eating together and singing hymns to the gods. This fulfills a deeper need reflected in music and the stories of the gods. Humans need beauty and some umbrella of meaning that underpins earthly existence as well as the more immediate and insistent requirements of organic existence. Missing the aesthetic and metaphysical aspects, Glaucon sees this as a city of pigs and ask for more luxuries, sweetmeats and soft couches. Enter the luxurious city. In the first city, there's a natural limit set by basic need. But is there a natural limit to luxury? A continually multiplying division of labor introduces into the city superfluous needs. The city becomes, in his words, measureless, feverish, and bloated. The natural resources controlled by the city are insufficient to meet these steadily expanded needs. Enter the third city, called the Purge City. A new class is needed, a military class dedicated to war in the search for new resources. Now, the training of the military involves a radically different lifestyle than that of the indulgent citizens. Training in gymnastics is obvious, but they are also trained in musique, that is, fine art. Too much gymnastic, Socrates says, makes one brutish. Too much fine art, effeminate. The right disposition is toughness and gentleness geared towards harming the enemies and benefiting the friends of the city. Now the military divides in 2, into guardians and auxiliaries. This furnishes the city with three classes. The artisans as the largest class, the auxiliaries as significantly smaller, and the guardians as few or even one. Socrates has completed the construction of the civic image of the soul that he now analyzes into three levels corresponding to the three levels of the city. The lower level is that of the appetites, the higher level that of the thumos or spirited part that is inclined to fight when one is challenged, and the top is the ruling part or reason. At this point, he pulls four virtues seemingly out of thin air, those that in subsequent tradition will be called the four cardinal virtues, that is, the hinges of moral life, temperance, courage, wisdom, and justice. He attempts to locate them in relationship to the three classes in the city. Wisdom lies in the ruling class and is linked to mind as the ruling aspect of the soul. Wisdom looks down on the lower appetites to govern them. In the city, courage is a typical virtue of the military auxiliaries that consists in dyed-in-the-wool patriotism and is linked in the individual to what the French call le cœur, or the heart, whose virtue is courage. Temperance, Socrates describes as the agreement of all as to who should rule. In the soul, that involves the subordination of desirous and competitive appetites to reason. What then is justice? Socrates suggests what it is by the old hippie motto, doing your own thing. Justice is the order that exists when each part does what's proper to it under the guidance of reason. One would think that we have what we're looking for, an insight into the nature of justice. But Socrates qualifies the previous. The courage here is citizen courage, suggesting there's another type. He says that if something appears in the soul that goes beyond this analysis, they would have to rework that analysis, especially if there's something we do, as he says, with the whole soul, and not simply with parts of the soul. Later on, he goes on to say, if we knew what justice is, so putting in question what he's done up to that point. So the description arrived at after the treatment of the cities and in relationship to the three parts of the soul, though significant, is insufficient to do justice to the nature of the soul. This takes us to the end of Book 4. Socrates is about to take the view of the city and the soul he developed as a measure to set up a hierarchy of civic and corresponding individual types according to how they approximate the rule of the wise. When the interlocutors ask him to tell more about one of his proposals, the community of wives and children. There will be no nuclear families, Socrates said. The best will mate with the best, and the children will be raised communally. I suspect that the and children in community of wives and children was not foremost in their minds, since Socrates does not first discuss what they ask, but first proclaim that women are equal to men and should be given equal education, as if to say, women are not to be objects of your prurient interest. They are equal to men, and the dispositions and intellect should be equally developed. Only then does he go on to discuss the community of women and children, at the end of which he says what seems again odd, that all Greeks are brothers, war between them should be viewed as a family quarrel, and should not lead to the enslavement of the losers. The way to make sense of this introduction is to see that Socrates is extending the circle of concern from the soul to the city and on to all Greeks. But that's preparatory to the next broadening he introduces by introducing the need for a philosopher king, which they did not ask for either. Socrates presents this figure as the condition without which humankind as such will live in misery. Now the circle of concern is extended from all Greeks to all humankind. This is not something that they asked for, but which Socrates links to it by describing the philosopher king as a peculiar erotic type. This calls for rising above the prurient erotic interest of the group to a real sublimation of eros. Whereas education in the perched city culminated in the appreciation of beautiful things, Socrates says that the philosopher is in love with the vision of beauty itself. The distinction between beautiful things and beauty itself opens up an understanding of the full scope of the orientation of the human soul. The philosopher king, Socrates says, is the contemplator of all time and all being. And that is because he's the lover of the vision of beauty itself that rules over all. The philosophic dimension of the soul is cosmopolitan. The philosopher is a citizen of the cosmos and not simply of a given city. Socrates uses three images, three soft twisted horizontal strands to describe the object of the philosopher's training. One, the sun as image of the good that occupies the place of beauty itself. Two, the diagram of the line. And three, the allegory of the cave. And these sit right in the middle of the dialogue. Socrates claims that just as the sun as source of light is what makes possible the completed relation of seeing to the seer, so also what he calls the good furnishes, quote, light for the relation between intellect and the intelligible. He goes on to fill the space between the two origins of light with an analysis of the field of experience. Socrates introduces a line, divided by a proportion and subdivided for the same proportion. If you follow the directions, you will discover that no matter what proportion you choose, the central segments will always be equal. So not just looking at, but thinking about what the line presents, we understand that we are dealing with a geometrical theorem that is true always and everywhere. A visual object, for example, the line in question, comes into being, changes, and passes out of being, while the geometric truth it exhibits never changes. Socrates then invites us to think about the nature of the mind that sees visual objects and apprehends geometric truths. While the eyeballs and the visual power that employs them are changing, the mind is oriented toward the realm of the unchanging intelligent. All time and all being that the philosopher is said to contemplate corresponds to the changing realm of the visual, all time, the unchanging realm of the intelligible, all being. I wish them well. So, while the eyeballs of visual power that employs them are changing, the mind is oriented toward the realm of the unchanging intelligible. All time and all being that the philosopher said to contemplate corresponds to the changing realm of the visual, all time, and the unchanging realm of the intelligible, all being. Now, Socrates claims that intellectual apprehension occurs, quote, in the light of the good. He puts us in position to cash on that metaphor of light by suggesting that as geometrical proof moves down with necessity from the axioms and postulates to the theorems, there should be a possibility of moving up from the fewness of the axioms and postulates. Thinking that through leads to the suggestion that the good is the one, the single principle governing all. It is in the light of the one that we understand anything. Hearing a multiplicity of sounds in a foreign language, we know what it is not to understand. To understand a language is to grasp the unity that underlies the multiplicity of words. Viewing the multiplicity of metric rules discovered in the building process, the geometer grasps the underlying unity through axiomatization and deduction. It is in the search for unity in otherwise incoherent multiplicity that we come to understand anything. And what Socrates is after is the origin of the general structure of the cosmos and human beings' place in it. The allegory of the cave puts the line into dramatic context, where down and up and darkness and light are central. Humans, by nature, are chained in a deep, dimly lit cave. By nature, we're chained to sensory presentations, and by being born into a culture, we are chained to the ways of understanding characteristic of that culture. Being unchained and forced to turn around, we can come to question the ways of understanding characteristic of the culture and what the senses reveal about the underlying things. Socrates sees human beings as chained, as he says, to images of justice in the law courts, such as he examined in the beginning of the dialogue. Being unchained, turned around, and dragged out of the cave into the sunlight of intelligibility indicates the difficulty of intellectual ascent to the region introduced by geometry. Turning around through reflection, through metanoia, or conversion, one ascends from semi-darkness to the light radiating all by the one good. Here is what going down and going up involves. Ascending from the darkness of embodiment and culture to the good as the light in which we can govern the body and reshape the culture. The view of the soul given at the end of Book 4 turns out to be a flat projection lacking the crucial dimension of depth that indicates the solidity of the human soul. Socrates indicates this obliquely when he underscores by peculiar device what plain geometry leaves out and what we should pursue with all the power of our minds, the dimension of depth. That depth dimension is the orientation upwards in the light of the one to the one as beauty itself. So we come to understand how the original metaphoric pairs up and down, light and dark, are used to indicate the full scope of the human soul's activity. The rational soul looks down to rule its appetites as the basis for looking up to the cosmic source towards which it is naturally oriented, understanding which is living in the light. Socrates also uses the image of the spinning top as a picture of the properly ordered soul. If the top finds the upright position, if it points straight up, the movements on its exterior support that position. If it deviates from uprightness, it begins to wobble. If it deviates too far, the top hits the ground and the top is carried erratically by the movements on the exterior. The upright position for the rational soul is the eros for the one as beauty itself. Oriented towards it, the sensory life on the exterior supports that orientation and produces the harmonious soul. The upshot of the whole argument is that the just soul is the soul that is in love with the good as the source. It is such a soul that experiences inward harmony that's much more than mere complacency, for it's combined with a passionate movement toward the source. The rational soul looks down to govern its lower powers so that it may be able to look up towards that which it seeks with all its power. One who is in love with the good wants to see orientation toward the good realized in the souls of men. Precisely what moved Socrates in his encounters with his dialogical partners. He returned to the cave to help release the souls from their chains, turn them around, and lead them upward toward the good. So there's an order and disorder of the soul, whether men or even God see it or not. It's an order generated by gathering its powers together and orienting itself towards what is highest. At the very end of the dialogue, in the myth of Earth, Socrates introduces the notion of rewards and punishments in the afterlife for justice and injustice in this life. What's important to see that is that, as in Kant's thought, rewards and punishments are not the motives of the real ascent of the soul. It is passionate love of the source and end as Alpha and Omega. What has this to do with a Christian worldview? St. Augustine structured his confessions around the notion of the restless heart that is made for God. Matching the term of Platonic ascent, the narrative of his life culminates in the exclamation, O beauty, ever ancient, ever new, late have I loved you. As a typical church father, Augustine went further, said that he read in the Platonists much of Christianity. The one is a source generating the logos as the region of the intelligible. The world soul as spirit turned toward the world. The fallen condition of humankind lying chained in the darkness, and the metanoia, or conversion, that turns us around toward the Father. But what he did not read, of course, was that the Logos became flesh. Platonism set Augustine on the right course that was completed by the revelation that is Christ. Against the background of Christianity, Kant retrieved part of Plato's project by distinguishing acting according to the ethical and acting because of the ethical. Honesty in business practice, so that you might make more money by being trusted, is not moral action, even though it's not bad action. It is the inner disposition that counts. So doing and avoiding the right things in life in order to escape punishment or gain reward in the afterlife, or to become prosperous in this life, is not moral action. Moral action involves doing the right thing because it is the right thing. One who is upright deserves rewards and punishments in the afterlife, but that cannot be the motive of a just life. Kant omitted the deeper dimension of passionate love for the good as Alpha and Omega that stands at the center of Plato's thought. The German poet Heinrich Heine, when he was outside at night looking at the stars with his mentor Hegel, remarked on the glory of God displayed in the heavens. Hegel, understanding where Heine was coming from, replied, "You want to get paid for taking care of your mother and not killing your brother." Hegel underscored here a problem with all too many Christians. They want to get paid for keeping the rules. The point of Plato's Ring of Gyges tale is abstraction from extrinsic rewards and punishments. Focus upon these additions to one's life deflects attention from the intrinsic order and disorder of the soul. Defocusing such an orientation, Plato leads us to see what it means to act out of passionate love for the good and source. It establishes an essential harmony. For such a soul, rewards and punishments are not part of the motivation. My point in this paper is that love of God sets us beyond our hopes and beyond our fears, leading us from the death of the soul into eternal life. Plato defined that and can lead us to act not out of the desire to get paid or out of fear of punishment, but out of aspiring love of the highest. And the way he taught that, he remains perennially relevant. Thank you.
We've got lots of time for questions, and I ask that you keep your statements brief and then jump into your questions.
Yep.
So who would like to start?
Yeah.
Cool. This gentleman over here.
Is a copy of your article available?
I could make it available.
Can we put it on our website?
Yeah, we sure.
To me, and then we can put it on the website.
Thank you for your remarks, especially about Kant's Out Street. Pretty much right, because it's right. Would you comment some on forgiveness and the woodworker from Nazareth that talked about forgiveness and how that relates to doing what's right because it's right, if it relates at all?
It isn't directly something I think Plato dealt with, at least not in the Republic. How can I bring it about?
Router?
Well, I'm speaking softly because I haven't got anything to say. I just hadn't thought about that dimension.
Oh, sure, we got more.
That was either transparent or so muddy you can't hear the question.
What are the best sources to understand how Plato influenced the gospel writers, the gospel authors?
Augustine's Confessions, for one. That's what he went through four conversions. One was conversion to philosophy with reading Cicero. Second was a conversion to Manichaeism, where he found the reason why he couldn't control his passions because the dark principle had a hold of him, and therefore he wasn't guilty. And the third conversion was to Neoplatonism, where Neoplatonism taught him that he taught him to realize what he was. He thought before that he and the divine and everything else was body, extension in some sense. Typical neurophysiologist today. Everything's body, mind is nothing but a passive byproduct. And Neoplatonism taught him to be aware of his own paying attention, taught him to be aware of the inner structural character of the mind itself, and introduced him to an order that actually, he says this, what I found in Neoplatonism was, in the beginning was the Word, the Logos, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In him was the life, through him all things were created, and without him was made nothing that has been made. In him was the life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shined in the darkness, and the darkness grasped it not. That's all in Plotinus and Plato. He found it right there. But one thing he didn't find, which is what Christianity is, the announcement of the incarnation of the Word. The Word was made flesh. The Logos was with us. And that changed the whole perspective, but it didn't eliminate the Neoplatonic understanding. Because the Neoplatonic understanding is based simply upon reflecting upon experience and seeing certain structures that are given to any rightly attuned mind. Yes.
Yeah. Well, when Plato later in the Timaeus refers to the world as a visible God, is that not an analogy to an incarnation? I mean, it's a less specific incarnation, but is there not a strain in Plato of kind of a an incarnation of the one or the good, if you will?
Yeah. Well, the visible God is not any particular individual. It's the cosmos itself, right? So it doesn't pertain to Christ as the unique Logos becoming flesh. Plato, however, is much more incarnational than we give him credit. There's two lines in Plato. One is, the body is the tomb of the soul, the body is the prison of the soul, the body is the mud bog of the soul, the body is that which encrustates the soul with gunk so you can't see what it is. So he thinks, well, Plato is a psychophysical dualist and hates the body. In the Timaeus, he says, use lots of words that are from oikeo, which means I dwell. So the body is the dwelling house of the soul, belongs there in some sense. And you can put those two together in this sense. What he's describing in these negative metaphors is the psychological problem of trying to rise above your passions and begin to see things clearly. What he's describing in the Timaeus is a cosmology. The ontological character of the body is to be the house for this kind of soul. And then the next step is Aristotle, who says, yes, and the soul builds its own house. At any rate.
Another question. In reading your abstract or your talk, you talk about if a person is no threat of of punishment and no promise of reward, they'll do what they want. I don't think I picked that up in your talk. Maybe you,
no, I did say that.
Okay, you said that. Okay.
That was a survey.
Okay. And I believe that's true. People do what they want, but something drives them to do what they do. And my point is that I don't think there are any absolute dictators that are benevolent, because the absolute dictator is in a position where he can do whatever he wants to do. And most of them apparently do what they want to do, and it's generally not very good. Can you address that?
Well, I'm pretty sure they're not thinking about rewards and punishments in the afterlife. They got it here and they can do what they want. The issue was, in the survey, what would you do if there were no afterlife? And 85% of the people said, I do what I feel like doing. What's the motive? But that's because we motivated people to think in terms of rewards and punishments. And what Dostoevsky, for example, has Ivan say, if there is no God, everything's permitted. And that allows Smerdyakov to kill his dad. And I keep telling my students, I said, everything isn't permitted. Nietzsche says this. There is no God, but not everything is permitted. The task of life is to compel the chaos that's within you to take on form, right? To shape it in some sense, to give it some kind of order, whether there's a God or not. Right? So the task of human life is this ordering of the soul. And the deepest order is generated by the eros for the highest good, right? Passionate devotion to the search for the highest good, its relationship to the rest of things. So that that's its own reward in that sense, right? It's the order that produces a tranquil soul in some way. But tranquil, not a complacent, but tranquil as steadily aimed at its end in some way, searching the order of the cosmos and it, looking for its source. So, I guess that's...
Okay, one of our students back here.
I was wondering how you would reconcile or change the currency through Christianity where you say we do good because it is good, or we should, or we should not be bad because it is bad, yet a system that has consistently for thousands of years breached reward, breached punishment almost constantly, and that's usually...
At a biblical ground.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that, in the Catholic tradition we have an act of contrition. It has two parts to it. Oh my God, I'm hardly sorry. I've offended thee because I dread the loss of heaven and the pains of hell. But most of all, because I've offended you, my God, who are all good and deserving all my love. And a friend of mine who was converted, he said, I couldn't generate this love for God, but I certainly could generate fear of punishment and looking for reward. And that's called, in our tradition, at least, imperfect contrition. At least you're doing some of the right things, but not for the right reason. That's what Kant makes a great deal of. Do the right things, not for the right reason. It's not moral action. It's not immoral action. It's amoral action. So following the rules is not sufficient. It's the motivation involved. It's a sufficient thing.
I can see why you would have the motivation within the Bible thing, within Christianity, to do the right thing. But now, you could have it because of reward and punishment, or you could have it because it's intrinsically the right thing. But I can't see in the case of no Bible or God I can't see but just one alternative, and that is to do whatever you think. Because what else is there besides whatever you think?
It's the order or disorder of the soul.
Now those three things there, in other words, when you go to Christianity, it doesn't mean you have to do a reward and punishment. You may be doing it because of the intrinsic good. Now, would you comment on that, or have you already covered that?
Well, I mean, I always bring this up to people. What about Plato and Aristotle, right? Their ethics was not based upon God. It was based upon the orientation of the soul and the order of the soul. So they don't see everything permitted. Everything's permitted in one sense, but you can mess up your life, right? As a way of not messing up your life, maybe ordering your life, no matter what the afterlife is.
We've been talking about this subject of several of these questions. Another slant on the same idea. There's an old question about, is the good good because God orders it, or is God ordering it because he perceives that it is good? And there are those, particularly cognitive psychologists and so forth, who say there are structures of the human mind such that people, in order to relate to others, etc., will behave in certain positive fashions in an altruistic mode as opposed to a selfish mode, etc., because this is hardwired into the human being. Can you speak to that?
Well, I mean, it does follow the idea that there's an order of human flourishing. And it certainly has a basis in the nervous system. What's the nervous system there for? To somehow direct us in some way. It's also, though, that which we can learn to program. That's what we do when we study. That's what we do when we learn a sport. We program our nervous system to make habits available to us when we want to use them in some way. So though we're programmed by our nervous system and by the culture, nonetheless, we can program ourselves based upon how we're determined by our genes, our upbringing, and our past choices. So we have that ability to program ourselves, to program our brain, as it were, the nervous system, in order to, as an athlete does, right? An athlete learns somehow to get his system in such a way that he can make automatic responses and succeed in the game.
I was thinking also in terms of Ayn Rand versus traditional Christian views, yeah. For example. Yeah. From her perspective, we would all be better off if we were more selfish, yeah. And not altruistic.
In virtue of selfishness.
Right.
Well, it isn't so much altruism that these people are talking about. They're talking really about just the right thing to do.
Which is selfish. I don't think so, but...
Well, certainly not in overt motivation, right? Mm-hmm. And you can certainly examine yourself to see what your real motives are, it seems to me.
And it does seem that we are not that way. In other words, there is something intrinsic within human nature that says we ought to behave in certain fashions.
Yeah.
And this is quite common across cultures.
Yeah, this, the appeal to what they call natural moral law.
Mm-hmm. Okay, question over here.
Well, it's kind of funny because I was, my question kind of feedbacks on the conversation. So we're having about morality, and I was curious as to whether or not there is a sort of moral objectivity or an absolute morality, if you will. Like, if you believe in moral, I guess the type of moral objectivity that's rooted, I guess, in abstract sense, or perhaps in God, or if you have any ideas on that?
Well, I mean, that's what this is about, somehow. The moral order is basically the order of the cardinal virtues, in one sense. Right? It's the way in which the soul is oriented, the way in which the rational power rules over the rest or doesn't, right? Or uses itself to pursue the lower appetites more efficiently, or something like this. So there is this order disorder. Aristotle has the same kind of idea.
I guess my other question, if you believe that we have moral intuitions, and would you say you believe that we have moral intuitions, or is that just something that's derived from rational thought? Our morality is derived rationally, as opposed to something out in the ether, some abstract entity?
Yeah, it's nothing out there. No, it's again, in both of these thinkers, what you have is an examination of the order and disorder in human life. And there are conditions for disorder, there's conditions for order. In the tradition that comes out of them, the natural moral law tradition, that there are hardwired, if you will, in us three levels of requirements. The first requirement is do good and avoid evil, and the second question is what's that? And the first level is preserve the conditions of your life. All animals and humans have that. Second is procreate and take care of your offspring, and animals do that, at least a higher level ones do. So that's built into the nature. The third is live in community and seek the that's the distinctively human orientation. And that's what we can use to create conditions in which the search for truth becomes more and more possible for human beings. So we don't put blocks in the way of inquiry. So we have an ongoing exploration of ourselves and the universe around us. So those are built into our nature, according to this tradition. And I think it just is the way it is. that the instinct is preserve our life. The instinct is procreate and take care of your offspring. The instinct is live in community. And overriding that, in one sense, is seek the truth. Because seeking the truth provides the principles for the critique of the community, which is what Plato and Aristotle are both doing, especially Socrates. That's what got him the hemlock.
I'd first like to address something my colleague Ken has said about not being a benign dictator. There are such things. Marcus Aurelius comes to mind.
Okay.
And Plato was a dualist, body, soul, body, spirit, body, mind. Of many modern people who believe that there is a dualism, that we just have this material thing that we can see, and that there is monism, one thing.
Material monism.
And then of those traditions that don't believe in an afterlife, Judaism, agnosticism, atheism, brings up the question of, do we need that, or do we need a sense of guilt that God sent his son to sacrifice and go to pay for us, and therefore anything that we do, or don't we feel guilty, that's act of contrition that you mentioned in the Catholic tradition. Can a person in modern society or in the world, even in old traditional primitive societies that did not believe in an afterlife, or even gods perhaps, aren't they capable of morals, of a moral living, of ethical living, of doing right and wrong without the idea of an afterlife or of reward and punishment? In other words, can a person be moral without believing in God?
That's why I was appealing to Plato and Aristotle. You don't have to have belief in God to see the order and disorder generated by human life. As a matter of fact, Plato has the good, which functions as some of the divine, but it's not watching over us and not giving us rewards and punishments. It's more impersonal. And I'm talking about those three roots of natural moral law, the fundamental instincts built into human beings. There was an experiment done after World War II when they got a group of people deliberately diverse, atheists, religionists, Buddhists, Christians, Jews, Muslims, etc., a whole group of people, and they had to sit down and talk, now, how do we have to organize this community so it can last beyond a few years? How can we develop it as an ongoing community over generations? And they came up with the last seven commandments in the table of the laws. These are the conditions for the possibility of human coexistence over long periods of time. Well, you don't kill somebody, you don't steal from them, you don't take their wife, right? You bear false witness against them, you're eroding the sense of community, right? So they become not, coming back to your observation, they're not right because God said they are. God said they are, they're right because they're right. That is, there is an order built into this sort of thing.
Do you think the author of the Gospel of Matthew, it's called Matthew, used Plato's allegory of the cave to describe the transformation, the spiritual transformation of the individual as set forth in the Sermon on the Mount to describe that process or to make it understandable?
I doubt if he knew about it. He could have, but I don't know that he did. The closest to come to the early thinkers post in the Christian era, Philo of Judea had the idea of the Logos, and there's some conjecture that the St. John's Gospel kind of picked that up to talk about the second person of the Trinity. I don't know how well that holds up, but certainly it's a suggestion. Which doesn't show any falsity, it simply shows there's something, could show this, it shows something true, and it's picked up by the Christian gospel in order to say something about the peculiarity of Jesus.
I noticed that you did your PhD dissertation on Martin Buber, and would you characterize, when Martin Buber talked about the I-thou relationship, would you characterize that, that would be one that would be perhaps rooted in justice, and the I-it relationship rooted in injustice, or how it, in other words, how would, what would Martin Buber say about your presentation tonight?
I would say it was a true vow. His distinction between I thou and I it is not a distinction between interpersonal relationships, relationship to things. It cuts across those kinds of relationships. His first experience of the I thou relation was a glittering piece of mica on a mountainside. That's the first thou that he experienced. So it isn't the person necessarily. Right? And the I it views everything as the object of experience and use. It's all self-centered in some sense. And this is what we build up the world of the I-it relationship in the persons. And so the I-thou relationship is ultimately it's a meeting that requires the wholeness of oneself and the wholeness of what presents itself. So it's an experience of some kind of wholeness, whole relationship, a kind of healing of the soul, as it were. And it's purely serendipitous. You can't give yourself that. It comes when it comes, if it comes. The best you can do is prepare for it by having the right kind of disposition. He speaks of this as a meeting of will and grace. I was thinking, did they get the program from Uber? Well, and then the upshot of it basically is this, that he sees this in Genesis, that everything is God's speech. Everything is addressing us in some way. So the speech is, God speaks the things out, but they are addresses to us in the form of God himself. He says, from age to age, we develop the armor of invulnerability against revelation. Just as nothing can hide from us the face of our fellow man as morality can, so nothing can hide from us the face of God so much as religion can. So it's very interesting. They're giving life to both morality and religion in some way.
Thank you for your talk. Another good Catholic Man, which also hosts the number one most watched cable network, Bill O'Reilly. The other night, he had a scholar on from Notre Dame, and she was calling him out because in his books and on his TV show, he doesn't call out the Sermon on the Mount. He doesn't call out that it's going to be harder for a rich man to get through the eye of a needle. He doesn't call that out. And she, the Notre Dame scholar, was calling him out. You're being dishonest about Christianity.
Why is that dishonest?
Because he was keeping stuff. He wasn't giving away all of his stuff to the poor. And he called her and said, well, you're just a loon if you think I'm going to give everything up.
Oh, that particular one, okay.
Yeah, so in the United States, it appears to me that religion, Catholicism, has given up. It's more the prosperity Christianity.
That's not
so it's okay to be rich. The guy in Houston, the super preacher in Houston, that it's okay to be rich. The persons give it all away. Where it seems like the rest of the world takes Christianity seriously on that point. So my question is Christianity considered reformed here in the United States, that it's more of a prosperity doctrine now than a give it up, you can't get to heaven?
Yeah, I haven't seen that in my tradition, because for a long time the first class Christians were those that did give it all up, right? The ones that gave up sex, that gave up property, that gave up self-determination, right? They were the first class. And the rest of us measure ourselves by their first class status. I wish Joel Osteen would preach on it's harder for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven than a camel to get through the eye of the needle.
But he doesn't.
Or woe to you rich. He doesn't say that, of course.
No.
I think that gospel of prosperity is not a Christian gospel. I think it leaves out the whole center of it. There was a guy, Reverend Ike, anybody hear him preach out in Boston years ago? He'd come on stage and he had this $1,200 suit, pulled up in Rolls Royce, diamond rings, slick back hair, black bourgeoisie women with mink and diamonds in the front row. He says, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven. All these things will be added to you. That's the reason.
Okay.
time for one more question. Do you have any other questions?
Can the individual act of choosing it good because it's good and avoiding bad because it's bad lead to, can it be a pathway by which the soul comes to love the good for its own sake? Or is there something else that's necessary?
Yeah, no, I think that's just exactly the case. I think of it sometimes, this woman did something noble to self, so I said, why'd you do it? Because it made me feel good. I said, well, I hope that wasn't why you did it. You see somebody in need and say, do I want to feel good today? Yeah, I feel good enough, forget it. So people typically don't act that way. Someone's in need, they run to their help, not to see, I'm going to get a reward for it. I need to feel good. They're in need, I have to help them. So that's responding to what's needed for its own sake, and that's on the way towards loving the good for its own sake.
1 minute ago, I lied and said we had time for one more question. Now we have time for one more question. Any last questions, Dr. Wood? Okay, let's get. Oh, what? So, young lady, I'll back over here.
I'm sorry. I think building on that comment and question, when you see the good and you do the good because it is good, what happens when you're met with situations every day? Where to be good, you would act on every situation if you gave everyone who asked for a dollar. So in a situation where you can't meet good every time there's a need, what does that do to the order?
You got to make choices. You can't run off in all directions at the same time. It's only you have to choose some and grab other ones going. You can't do everything.
But that wouldn't lessen your goodness?
No, because you're doing the good. In one sense, can't do good to everybody. First I got a family, so I got to take care of them, and I can't worry about other people unduly because my family is my first obligation. So we do this kind of order of obligations, and therefore deciding, in one sense, what the priorities are for me in this situation.
So we want to present a certificate of appreciation to Dr. Wood for coming here tonight and speaking to us on Plato. And let's give another round of applause.